Good. Well, good morning. We're in yet starting yet another week in our pandemic response, and I have to remind myself every week how early we are still in this pandemic. Compared to what we're going to have to do, we're still in the very early stages of response. The nationally and statewide, the numbers continue to go up. So we're now at about 775,000 cases of COVID-19 in the United States. In Washington State, it's closer to 12,000, and nationally, we've had over 41,000 deaths. In Washington State, it's 634 is the current mortality count. And in Jefferson, our positive count has now held stable for 11 days, and so at 28. And that's of about 705 tests that have been done and returned. So that's running about 4%, as opposed to almost 9% at the state level. I should note, if anyone looks at the Washington State, the Department of Health has a special coronavirus page, and it has each of the counties of Washington, and you can click on them and get numbers. And the Jefferson County numbers are way off. They show that we've only done 248 tests, and so they divide that, the 28 positives, by 248, and they get a positivity rate of 11.8%. Actually, we've done almost three times that many tests. And so we've notified the state of this, and Collin County is having the same problem. And we're pretty sure it's that one of the big labs did not report their negatives to the state. So either Quest or LabCorp didn't do that. So they're tracking that data down, and we'll correct the state site. But we actually had some people comment on that, is that that's a positivity rate that's significantly above the state average would be an alarming thing indeed. But fortunately, that data is not correct. So what's going on statewide is in the two most heavily impacted counties, Snohomish and King, the outbreak has essentially plateaued, or at least as measured by hospitalizations and death rates, which are kind of our most accurate measures, since we're not testing near as many people as we would like to. But those who are sick enough to require hospitalization, that seems to have stabilized and is dropping just slightly. Here on the Olympic Peninsula, so this applies to both Clallam and Jefferson County, we have seen no positives for the last 11 days. Clallam County, the rate of positives has really slowed there, too. And neither of us are really experiencing a medical surge. We hope it stays that way, but we have no guarantees. And this is only the first wave. So we here in Washington State, we've dealt with, or we're in the process of dealing with the first wave, but we think there's going to be other waves. And the overwhelming imperative of this is to try to control those as best we can. So we know that the good news in this is that we know that physical distancing works. It's an extreme measure. It has enormous economic cost, but it does slow the progression of the infection through the population. So we have that as an important tool. We also know, and kind of the bad news of this, is that the gains, especially in King County and Snohomish, are precarious. That if, for instance, they were to stop their community mitigation efforts, they would start to be right back into exponential growth in 1 to 2 weeks, and they would be starting from a very different place than they did at the beginning. So they would be starting from a plateau rather than a baseline. And the projections are that their surge, a surge at this point, if it resumed, would be 3 to 5 times worse than the surge that they're having now. And the surge that they had now, they were able to stay within their capacity for ICU beds, but just barely. And they were well within their capacity for hospital beds. But the critical need with this particular disease is the ICU beds, where you can do intensive medical therapies. As Commissioner Dean mentioned in her presentation, I was just listening to, the situation in Eastern Washington is much more uncertain.
Oh, we lost you, Thomas.
We've lost you, Dr. Locke. We can't hear your audio.
You might have to call in on the phone.
You're going to have to charade the rest of your presentation.
Or use the phone number and call in, Dr. Locke.
Okay. So how about now?
That's good.
Got it back? Okay. I just reset the mic. So it's good? Okay, good. Where did I cut out? Was I talking about Eastern Washington?
I'm Eastern Washington.
Yeah. Okay, great. So there may still be a surge coming for places like Yakima and Spokane. It's uncertain. But we're already in the state where we're working to plan the next stages of this. We had a big statewide phone conference on Saturday to go over exactly that. What comes next? And the challenge, of course, is to resume as much economic activity, recreation, travel, all of these things that give quality to life without triggering a new surge. And you've probably seen there are a number of different plans. There's a national plan. There's a state plan. Something that they all have in common is they involve increased testing, and so that's our big push this week. You know, our testing protocols up to this point have really been defined by scarcity. Scarcity of lab resources, scarcity even of the specimen collection kits, you know, the 2 cent swabs that are needed to collect specimens have been in incredibly short supply. But those things are finally starting to be fixed. Washington State's supposed to get 1 million swabs today. The labs have built up their capacity. So we're very close to, we think this week, we'll be able to finally start doing what we wanted to do all along, and that is very intensive testing. So essentially test anyone with any kind of respiratory or COVID-like illness, fever, cough. And then in addition, doing a lot more outbreak investigations where when we have a case, especially when it's in these high-risk transmission environments, like healthcare settings, long-term care facilities, among first responders, where what we really wanted to do is not just test the people with symptoms, but test their contacts as well, because we know that asymptomatic infection is part of this. Also, pre-symptomatic spread, so people who are going to get sick, they shed the virus before they know that they're ill. And we think that if we do more testing in those situations, we'll pick up more cases. They've already found that in some of the long-term care facility outbreaks that they've been managing. And there's been over 58 here in Washington State. And when they test everyone in the long-term care facilities, they find a bunch of workers who are infected, who are working because they don't know they're infected. They don't feel sick. We're not exactly sure how infectious they are, but we do know that they are infected with the virus and they're shedding it and maybe part of the outbreaks that we're dealing with. So we're changing our testing protocols to really encourage a lot more testing. However, that's not going to be enough. We all agree that we have to, when we get the positive test, we have to react in very fast, very aggressively to investigate cases, identify all contacts, get people appropriately isolated or quarantined, actually do all of this within 24 hours of learning of the case, and then do a bunch of things to monitor and support people during their isolation and quarantine. In the first way, we barely had resources to do this. You know, we basically investigated cases, identified contacts, gave them a bunch of advice, and then moved on to the next case. And we have to do better than that. We have to really check in with people daily and support them and make sure they have the services they need and monitor them for early signs of infection. My model for this is what the city of Toronto did in 2003 when they had a SARS outbreak that it was in their several hospitals. It was really moving quickly, and they did this model isolation and quarantine where not only did they put a lot of people into these restricted environments, but they supported them. They made it possible for people to stay at home and to not have to get groceries and do all these things. Yeah.
I was wondering, so with the additional testing capacity we hope to have by the end of the week, it sounds like, would more testing be done? Like if there was a confirmed case, would when they ended their isolation, would all of their caregivers or close family members be tested at that point, at the end of an isolation?
More likely in the middle part of it, we're still trying to figure out the value of doing testing of asymptomatic contacts because one of the problems with the test that the test is good at ruling in the infection. If you have a positive test, you really have it, but it's not good at ruling it out. So if you get a negative test, it doesn't eliminate the possibility. So we're certainly will be doing a lot of testing of contacts in these outbreak situations where there's high risk of exposure and some contacts, you know, there is an argument for just testing them 7 days after exposure, because if they're going to be infected, that's when we should be able to pick it up. But we've got to be really careful about the timing, because if we test too early, we could end up telling someone who had the infection that they didn't have it, and then they would potentially leave quarantine and start a new outbreak somewhere else. This will be a learn as we go. But what I'm predicting is we'll be doing more and more testing, with household members, we'll be quarantining two whole households and probably testing whole households, because that's a high risk situation for transmission, and we have to, you know, as in the first wave response, what we were essentially doing is what in public health is called passive surveillance. You kind of wait for the disease to come to you. You wait for people to get sick and seek medical care and get tested. And what we have to move to is what's known as active surveillance, where we are doing things to actively seek out and find cases and aggressively identify them and then use that to control outbreaks. Because the better we get at putting out these kind of spot fires, the more people can open up economically, knowing that will increase the risk of spot fires, But if we're really quick at putting them out, we can control it that way. So we don't have to use the blunt tool of physical isolation and can use sort of more precise control strategies. So that's the goal, but it's going to require a system that we don't currently possess. And that's what we're really scrambling to produce at a state level. Countries are trying to do this all over the world. And we're trying to learn from the ones that are doing it most successfully. Right now, South Korea, Taiwan, and New Zealand, all doing it in sort of different ways, but they're really the success story. And South Korea is actually doing so well that they're starting to open up economically again. And at least at this early stage, doesn't seem to be stirring up activity. There aren't many advantages to being in a pandemic situation, but one is the whole world is struggling with the same problem. And so we can learn from them just as they learned from us. And we're trying to do that. Where it's shaping up now is that, you know, we're trying to build up this testing and response system. We think that the current stay home, stay healthy initiative will certainly stay in place for the duration of the initial order. So that's May 5th. In the very near future, it's likely that certain kind of construction activity will resume, because that seems to be one of the safest things to do. It just involves a lot of natural physical distancing. We also think that there's a lot of recreational things that can be done safely. You know, fishing and hiking and solitary sports, where also people can maintain physical distancing and can avoid the kind of interactions that transmit infection. So those things will likely be coming online. But how fast we can move is in large part going to depend on how good we are at detecting and preventing the transmission of new cases. Because we know they're going to be there. What we can't do is completely get rid of the infection from the state. There's always going to be this smoldering level of infection until most of the of the state is immune, either by natural means or because hopefully because of a vaccine. I might just touch on one other topic, because getting a lot of questions about it. There's a lot of hopefulness about it, and that is these tests for immunity, these so-called serologic tests. And what they're actually physically testing is when you get an infection, almost any infection, and certainly this coronavirus infection, your body produces two different types of antibodies. One type it produces within the first week of infection, and then that drops off after a week or two. And then the second type starts at about week two and is the persistent form. And that's the form that we hope will produce immunity. But we don't know. We know there's this measurable antibody that's produced in the infection. We don't know for sure what kind of immunity it gives people. What's happened is there are lab tests. They're very precise and actually expensive lab tests that can be done to measure antibodies that are specific to the pandemic coronavirus strain. But there's also been this explosion of what are called point of care tests. So they're little portable kits. You put a drop of blood on them. It tells you in a couple minutes whether you have antibodies or not. There's 60 different companies that are producing these, and it's virtually unregulated. It's anyone who can make the test who wants to. The quality varies. They have all kinds of problems with false positives, false negatives. And probably the biggest problem they have is it appears most, maybe all of the portable kits cross-react to these to other types of coronavirus, and there are four major types of coronavirus that are circulating in a given year. That it's a common cold virus, and it's not uncommon. Every flu season, about a third of the cases of flu-like illness we see are in fact caused by circulating coronaviruses. And so the tests are really not going to tell us necessarily whether you've had COVID-19 or whether you've had one of these relatively harmless circulating coronaviruses. So this first round of tests, at least the point of care test, is really not looking to be useful at all. But there are lab-based tests that are a lot more accurate, and we're starting to see some of the study results from those. There's a big study done in Santa Clara in California, where they just tested antibodies for random selection of the population. That was running about 2.5 to 4% of people showed antibodies, which is way more, a factor of 40 to 50 times more cases than you would expect just from the confirmed cases. They're doing a similar study in Seattle, where they have what's called bank sera. So it's just blood tests done over the month of March, and they're randomizing them and de-identifying and testing them. And those results are supposed to come out this week. The preliminary reports are it's running about 2%, 2% to 2.5%. of people show evidence of being exposed. So that really confirms, if that information bears up, it really confirms the fact that a lot of cases of this are asymptomatic, half or more, which makes it even more challenging to control. And there's also some discouraging research out of South Korea that says among the people with asymptomatic infection, they don't develop protective immunity. So they get it, they get over it quickly. That's the good news. The bad news is they don't get the benefit of an immune response, so they can get it again. But this, we're learning things day by day, and all of these kind of findings are preliminary, and what's found in one study may be refuted by the next study that comes down the road. But we're trying to pay attention to those because they make a difference. They sort of help guide our response. So I'll leave it at that. I did look at the KPDZ questions. I tried to incorporate those in as much as possible. There were a lot of questions about testing, and the way I'd summarize that once again is we're finally pretty much going to be able to do testing for anyone who needs it. And that's not quite the same thing as anyone who wants it, because some people want testing that have no exposure history and have no signs of illness, and that test very likely will be negative and won't show them anything at all, really. But we do want to be testing these higher-risk populations. And at this point, given the fact that the flu season is gone, it just usually it trails off slowly over the month, but it just disappeared. In March, our flu tests dropped to zero, the number of positives, and stayed there. So that's another consequence of all the hand washing and social distancing and respiratory etiquette, and a good one, because now it makes us easier to pick the needles out of the haystack, because the haystack of respiratory illness is now a lot smaller than it was. And virtually anyone at this point who has a fever with a cough or with shortness of breath, we want to test you. And in most cases, we can do it in the drive-by clinic. But if you're sick enough to be evaluated, Jefferson Healthcare has the respiratory evaluation clinic is still operational and will be operational for the foreseeable future. So I'll leave it at that. Open things to questions.
Go ahead, Philip.
Yeah. So thank you very much, Dr. Locke. And I'm in your call with health officers over the weekend, and you know, given the challenges of the asymptomatic transmission, and you know, we saw ill-advisedly the president really encouraging citizens really to ignore medical advice on social distancing and to challenge state authorities on stay home, stay safe orders. And we saw 2,000 people demonstrate in Olympia this weekend. I hope they don't get sick. So the willingness to recognize the need for social distancing is becoming more strained. Incidence is beginning to plateau, or in our case, it may be starting to go down. But yet, with the challenges of asymptomatic, the challenges of the antibody testing is a ways away, it sounds like, financially at least. You know, how do we manage through this, and how do we manage so that we don't get right back to where we were, or worse, as you were pointing out with King County?
Something I didn't comment on, it looks like what's going on in Clallam, Jefferson County, we really are in a better place, or at least we're about 3 to 4 weeks earlier in the epidemic curve. So we have more of a buffer. Although there's an alternate view of that, is it's going to be harder for us to tell when if we're losing ground, you know, because we have such low case levels. But that's yet to be determined. It's going to be a step by step process and learning as we go. But something that the science tells us and everyone agrees, you know, all the health officers and the various health and infectious disease specialists, is that very aggressive testing is sort of the cornerstone strategy. Is we have to know who's infected, and we have to break the cycle of transmission from those infected individuals. Because, as I said, social distancing is an incredibly blunt tool. You know, distancing two people from each other where neither of them is infected does no good whatsoever. It just imposes a burden on them without benefit. So it only counts if you're distanced from someone who is carrying the infection. So the more people with the infection that we can kind of remove temporarily from the community, you know, until they recover, the safer the community becomes. You know, the less of a chance you have of picking up the infection when you're out and about and doing things. And then that in turn allows people to do more things. But we have to take it way slower than people want to, because the consequence of failing, you know, and restarting the transmission when we're at the top of the plateau rather than the bottom of the plateau, is catastrophic. And so it's going to be really frustrating to people it's just, I think, human nature to want to believe, okay, we've solved this one, we've conquered this disease, and we can move on. We can get back to how things were before. But in fact, we're just at the earliest stages of it. And the more we learn about the virus, the more we realize how hard it's going to be to contain unless we have either effective antiviral medicines or a vaccine. Because it's a stealth virus. It spreads through people who do not have symptoms. And it attacks really capriciously. We know the risks are highest related to age. Obesity now appears to be a very dominant risk factor for complications. People have seen the accounts in the press of it striking and killing children, and young adults, and those are all very true. So it can affect anyone. You don't know if you're going to be the one with a mild case, or someone, you know, who ends up in the hospital on a ventilator. So it's something. Another factor that's probably going to slow the opening up of society is people are really afraid. You know, given this stealth nature and the catastrophic health consequences, people are going to, you know, even when we tell them that it's okay to be more active in society, a lot of people are not going to feel comfortable doing that. And people who are at high risk of complications should look at this as it's months, they're months and months away from being able to safely move in the community. Although we hope with better testing that we'll be able to give them a better idea of, you know, what the risks are, and at least you know, allow some activities, you know, once we determine that they're safe. Another thing, we have to make our hospitals safer. It was just an outrageous situation that hospitals had to deal with this first wave with inadequate personal protective equipment. That's a problem that's now starting to come around too. Washington is finally starting to get some stable supplies of the most crucial equipment. So we'll be better prepared to protect healthcare workers because those are cases that shouldn't happen. You know, that should not be a price you pay for taking care of people with COVID-19 that you get the disease yourself. We know how to prevent that, but it takes equipment to do it right.
Great, thanks. David or Kate, any other questions for Dr. Locke today?
I have a question. Dr. Locke, I think you have expressed before that you don't see visitors, second home owners coming to the county as a major risk. So curious if you still feel that way, given we just had another beautiful weekend and lots of reports of downtown being packed and certain areas being impossible to practice social distancing. And related to that question would be, do we know where transmission is continuing to happen, what our highest risk behaviors are? You know, for example, we also need to go to the grocery store to some degree. Do we have any idea where transmission is happening to be able to rule out that visitors, even if it's just a day trip to our region, is not a risk?
Yeah. So the first off, I qualify the what we don't have evidence of is that people, travelers are importing the disease into the area in any kind of significant or detectable degree. It's why we don't, for instance, recommend that anyone who leaves Seattle quarantine themselves for 14 days. They've done that in some states, and actually for good reason. But things have not been that bad in Washington State to justify that kind of recommendation. But if visitors are causing crowding, that is a problem because they can be asymptomatically infected, or they can have mild illness, and their chances of exposure are greater in the I-5 corridor counties than they are here. So that's one of the reasons we're trying to prohibit travel. But I would be very concerned if it's causing deterioration of the social distancing requirements. And that's the problem with everyone wanting to go to the beach at the same time or flocking to downtown, is that it's nothing makes that safe to violate that 6-foot separation. And it's why we're really discouraging people from doing that kind of travel. We hope that in the not too distant future, with better testing, it will be less risky. So there'll be less infected people moving about in the community, But right now, it's just completely unknown. You cannot tell if the person who's 6 feet away from you is carrying this infection or not. It's probably safer if that person is wearing a mask. They're less likely to transmit it. But it's also probably true that you wearing a mask doesn't give you much protection, except for the fact that it does keep you from touching your mouth or your nose. And that is beneficial. So I would say we haven't identified outbreaks associated with travelers, but that doesn't mean it's safe, and that doesn't mean it should be encouraged. And specifically, the governor's order prohibits that kind of activity. So people that are doing it are not only violating a lawful directive, but they're violating the spirit of it too. They're not taking this emergency seriously, and so people have a right to be upset with that. We ask people not to be policing social distancing or policing masking policy. That's still kind of an individual choice for people, but it's undeniable there are risks associated with it, and they're preventable risks. People don't have to be doing these behaviors.
Dr. Locke, people are isolating in couples, for example, at home, and then I see them go out on walks as a couple, and they're staying the distance as a couple from everybody else. And that's confusing for people to see two people together on the walk, but they're staying away from the groups.
Yeah, and that's a reasonable thing for them to do. I mean, their household members are exposing each other in innumerable ways, and so it doesn't really make sense for them to walk 6 feet apart. And that's part of the reason I encourage not to be judging other people. Yeah, you don't know who lives in a household with someone else or who doesn't. We for instance, have recommendations for construction crews that we recommend that people drive in separate cars unless they live in the same household. If they're already living in close proximity, they don't gain anything for driving in separate vehicles. I've actually seen couples walk 6 feet apart, and it's probably just because they don't want people giving him the stink eye for violating social distancing.
Great, thank you, Dr. Locke. A little bit more about policing our neighbors, happening a little bit, but there were some questions about vacation rentals and transient rentals, short-term rentals, and I just want to make sure that we've put out a press release indicating that if it's there's essential activities that can take place, but don't go out of county to vacation. But if someone does see someone violating that, they should, I'm making sure they should go on to the state coronavirus.law.gov website to report that before they report it locally. I just want to make sure that's the correct process.
Well, it is, in this case, it's a violation of a governor's directive, as opposed to a local ordinance or order. And we have the licensing of these transient rentals. It's highly variable, but we've looked at that. And the one at the health department we're involved with is the bed and breakfast. So we've sent out notices to all the bed and breakfasts now, telling them basically what's legal and what's not legal. So there are certain emergency workers that you can offer lodging to, but for most of them, they should really be closed down until things open up. But I think at this point, all the various vacation rentals have been notified. Another phenomenon we have, especially in Port Townsend, is second homes. So we have people who live in cities and have property here, and that's I'm not sure that violates the letter of the governor's directive. It certainly violates the spirit and the travel part of it. But I don't see legally how we can, if that's someone's legal home, they're allowed to stay in it if they want to.
Great. Thanks for that clarification. I'm also wondering, I was talking before you came on about possibly, you know, sending a letter to the governor saying, hey, you know, construction industries, retail construction, and some other industries, would you consider making them, reclassifying them as essential? You mentioned that might be coming soon. You know, I'm also concerned about things like healthcare workers. You know, as once we get over this, the PPE shortage, you know, there's a lot of diagnostic and surgeries and all sorts of things that aren't happening now. And when is it an appropriate time to, I guess, give our feedback to the governor saying, hey, there's a lot of these industries which we think should be considered essential now because, you know, we're kind of dealing with a bimodal outbreak, as you've used before. But the second mode is our, you know, economic status. And it's going to be harder. It's getting harder and harder to start that wheel of industry up again. So I'm conscious of looking for places that we can stay within the spirit, but still encourage the governor to, you know, start the engines. And I'm wondering, I guess, if that seems reasonable to you at this point. Is it premature?
Yeah, no, it very much seems reasonable. And I know there's a very active process going on now. And the reason I know is the health officers, we've received kind of proposals about construction startups and infection control and distancing protocols to comment on. That was actually over a week ago. So, you know, we commented on those, and it was from the governor's office. They were sort of floating these proposals for, okay, what sort of construction can we bring online? Because they're very eager to do that. That's a priority thing. And most people agree it can be done safely if it's done right. And then the other one, some hospitals are actually starting up elective surgeries again because the hospitals are almost empty. They cleared out, they canceled all these procedures to make way for the surge, and now as the surge is dissipating, they have the capacity to do the surgery. They're starting with procedures that where there's fairly short turnaround, where you go in and you're out of the hospital in 2 or 3 days, so that they're not committing that bed for a long period of time in case a surge comes back. But they're very eager to do that, and the increased testing helps too, because they can test patients prior to surgery and just make sure that they're not infected, because not only would that be an infection control problem for the hospital, but it'd be a danger for someone to come in and have their hip replaced and then come down with COVID-19 at the same time. As we have the testing capacity to do that, we'll be using it. So that will be starting back up again as elective surgery, and we think it can be done very safely.
Great. And my last question, I was just wondering, have we had any kind of clustered outbreaks in Jefferson County? Or, you know, I know that roughly 2/3 of our cases are from in-county transmission, but can you give us a little bit more of a picture of that?
Yeah, we only had one that you would call a cluster, and that is a licensed residential care facility where, fortunately, it was a fairly small cluster. It was, there were a bunch of things going on at once. So there were people with influenza. There were people with non-COVID, non-influenza. They tested negative for everything, and then there were 4 cases of COVID-19. And we got the state involved, as we like to do in these situations, and really with the focus on making things as safe, bringing the outbreak under control, which we think we've done now, and then making things as safe as possible. To prevent it from happening again, because it, you know, our goal is not to close down long-term or long-term care facilities or any kind of residential treatment facilities. The people getting those services really need the services desperately. And so we've got to figure out ways to keep them open, but not not cause outbreaks. So we for this one, the Department of Health has a real an excellent. They're called the Healthcare Associated Infection Strike Team, and they're the ones that come into nursing homes and things and try to help them re-engineer their processes. And we took advantage of that in Jefferson County and had went through that kind of process.
Great. Yeah, that's that. Thank you. Any last questions for Dr. Locke? All right. Well, as always, thank you very much, Dr. Locke, for your continued work and diligence. And we will see you again next Monday. And with that, we'll pass it off to Willie Bench, Director of the Jefferson Department of Emergency Management.
Yeah. Thank you, Commissioner. And as always, mine will be relatively brief, just since Dr. Locke is able to cover things on a much more kind of comprehensive level than I. But speaking to personal protective equipment, we continue to see some trickle in from the State Emergency Operations Center. We're specifically seeing needs being met around N95s, gloves, things like that. There still are some fairly critical shortages around gowns, eye protection, things like that. So it's a little bit better in certain areas, but it's just nice seeing that start to trickle in. Because as Dr. Locke attested to, for the ramp up testing, it's not just a matter of getting test kits and test transports. We need that personal protective equipment as well to protect healthcare workers. So right now, we're still working on a 7 to 10 day cycle where we're getting PPE in about once a week just to meet the interim needs. But we're starting to think a little bit longer term in terms of how much we're going to need as we begin to, again, reopen society, expand testing, all that kind of stuff. Our mask program continues to be going very well. I don't have the exact number right now, but I believe it's well over 1,000 at this point, homemade masks that have been donated and distributed. Again, every time we get masks in, we check them for quality, and then we put them out at our distribution sites. They're usually gone within a couple of hours. So please continue to make and donate masks and then pick them up if you need them. So it's been very nice to see how well that's been going. It was also discussed some of the protests this weekend, specifically here in Washington and Olympia, as well as nationwide. We've been keeping an eye on those and what that means locally for us. I will say, although those protests have gotten a lot of news coverage, they are kind of a spectacle to be seen. A couple of surveys that I saw pin about 70 to 80% of Americans across the nation are supportive of stay-at-home, stay-safe type measures, and an even greater number than that are actually adhering to those orders. So what we're really witnessing in terms of these protests is a pretty vocal, pretty visible minority of Americans. And I don't want someone who's kind of sitting on the fence right now, well, do I stay home, do I stay safe, or do I start advocating for, you know, kind of an advanced reopening, putting everyone's lives at risk? I don't want to let those protests they're seeing on the news sway their opinion towards, you know, going out and putting others in danger. So, and we're keeping an eye on those. I hope not to see any more. I hope for the protesters' sake they don't get sick after such a large-scale exposure. But just as you're watching that on the news, just know that most Americans support stay home, stay safe, and are adhering to those guidelines. We want to continue to see people practicing those safe social measures. Other than that, again, it's been nice to see the effectiveness of stay home, stay safe. We are in a little bit of a lull right now in terms of positives. We're using that to accomplish some more long-term planning. All the agencies in the EOC are looking at staffing patterns over the long term. We're starting to put together kind of a long-term timeline of response activities, what we need to be doing month by month. So, you know, like Dr. Locke mentioned, these first 2 months or so have been kind of an initial sprint, but this is really a marathon, and we're really early on in this pandemic. So we're starting to put together what we need to do long term. But that's pretty much for us. Again, PPE has been at the forefront of what we've been doing and working to support all of the agencies that make up EOC. So that's all I've got.
Great. Thank you, Willie. Any questions for Mr. Bence? I guess I have one just clarifying question. You talked about kind of short-term and long-term planning. What are the different, I guess, thresholds that you're looking at? You're looking at, you know, till the end of May, to the summer, 18 months, or what kind of?
Yeah, initially, we had a discussion Friday on our EOC informational call. Basically, what are you worried about a month from now, 3 months from now, 6 months from now, a year from now? Because, you know, we were really doing a lot of work to prep for this first initial surge. But as we've seen, again, stay home, stay safe has been very effective towards flattening the curve. But we're really looking at the possibility of kind of rolling curves. So we get little bumps every so often as we see those fires Dr. Locke is testing to. So we'll see a little bit of a flare up and then we go back down and another little flare up and then it goes back down. So we're starting to plan for, you know, how we manage those individual bumps, what we have to do between bumps to prepare for the next one, et cetera. Just because, again, but like Dr. Locke had previously attested to, this is very much a marathon. We're very early into this. So we're going to have to work at putting out a lot of those individual fires and individual bumps. And as we slowly start to both return to normal, but also identify our new normal and start operating within that new framework, we need to be ready to basically turn the pieces on bit by bit. So we're just starting to look at what that actually means and what we need to do to get ready for it.
Great. Thank you, Willie. All right. Well, again, a very informative update. If there's no more questions, I saw that we had our next guest has arrived. So I guess we will let you go, Dr. Locke and Mr. Mintz, and we'll see you next Monday at the same time and same virtual place. Thanks a lot.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.